Hello, friends and fellow legal-minded thinkers. Welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm Paul Townsend, your host and guide, as we discuss a topic which has become surprisingly polarizing. But first, as some of you have seen if you've been following the show on social media, I have a shiny new website. You can listen to episodes, send feedback, watch some clips of legal commentary, or read some legal articles I've written on some of the topics covered in the various episodes of the show. I'm very excited and would love to hear people's thoughts on the website. It's insummation.com. Please check it out, send me your feedback, let me know. Putting this episode together was a huge struggle for me. The more research I did, the more there was to discuss. My first outline of the episode would have had me talking for maybe 90 minutes. I've cut it down to what I think is an appropriate length for the show, but I've still had to gloss over a lot of topics which I actually think are fairly important. The show is nearly a year old at this point. Those of you who listen to each episode, I'll ask you, if you want longer episodes to cover a little bit more and more in depth, write me and let me know. If I don't hear anything, I'll assume everyone wants to keep them where they are. But if you want me to go into a bit more detail and go to maybe 45 to 50 minutes, please let me know. I'll try to add articles and blog posts here and there on my website to address certain topics that I can't get to on the main show as necessary for the legal nerds who want a little more analysis. Okay, on to today's episode. We're going to be looking at a few very important legal issues that deal with the scope of a prosecutor's authority. At first, I was surprised at how many people I spoke to about these took opposite stances and how strongly emotions were tied into these positions. We're going to go into some detail on the arguments for the authority of prosecutors to do certain things and against prosecutors having the authority to do these particular things, and how each side is coming at the problem differently, resulting in different approaches. The big question today is to what extent a promise made by a state prosecutor is binding on his or her office in perpetuity. When the DA enters into an explicit agreement with a defendant that it will not prosecute a case, and the defendant relies on that promise, should that bind the DA's office in the future? Are there any circumstances in which a later DA can break that promise? We're also going to touch on decisions that district attorneys make in deciding whether to bring charges or not. What goes into that determination, and what are the important factors which a prosecutor considers? Now, we're looking at this in the context of a case which everyone has some familiarity with. But I personally believe very few people actually understand. This is another one of those cases where a little bit of easily digestible information was given to the public and ideas were formed. But the full picture is far more complicated, and journalists either don't want to go to the trouble of understanding it all to write it all down, or they don't feel that their readers would really follow it regardless. So they only present the beginning of the basics. This case deals with a comedian who portrayed himself for decades as a wholesome funny man, who managed to hilariously critique society through stories of his own childhood and family, and while not resorting to foul language or graphic innuendos. But privately, people started to whisper that this man was not the squeaky clean comic he portrayed himself as. Rumors started creeping in that he, for years, for decades really, had been sexually abusive towards women. In 2014, those rumors really became thrust into the public when another comedian incorporated them into a recurring stand-up routine he was working on. Once public, they spread like wildfire. Women began coming forward and publicly accusing this icon of the comedy industry of sexual assaults. He was ultimately arrested and convicted of assaulting a single accuser in a case that had many legal scholars scratching their heads. Ultimately, his conviction was overturned on appeal, and the Court of Appeals instructed the lower courts that they absolutely, under no circumstances, could try the case again involving these particular charges. And we're going to discuss why. This is The state of Pennsylvania versus Bill Cosby. Like so many people we cover on this show, Bill Cosby truly needs no real introduction. But as is our custom, I'll provide a little background information so you can fully appreciate how his story impacts what unfolded. Cosby was born on July 12, 1937, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His mother, Anna Pearl, was a maid, and his father, William Cosby Sr., served in the Navy. In school growing up, to nobody's great surprise, Cosby was a class clown. He was immensely popular. He served as his junior high school class president and was captain of his baseball and track teams. He started at Philadelphia's Magnet Central High School, where he continued to participate in athletics, but the academics were a bit too rigorous. He transferred to Germantown High School for his sophomore year, but he failed the 10th grade there. Not really seeing the point in a high school education, Cosby followed his father's footsteps and enlisted in the Navy in 1956. He did get his high school GED through correspondence courses, which is kind of like internet classes before the internet existed. After he got out of the Navy, he got a track and field scholarship to Temple University in Philadelphia. While in college, he got a job bartending to make extra side money, and he quickly learned that he could earn better tips by making patrons laugh. He also quickly discovered that he was really good at making patrons laugh. The bar management picked up on Cosby's natural ability to make people feel good and put him on stage performing. It's then that Cosby decided to ditch his university studies and pursue a career in comedy. In 1961, Cosby began his comedy career in earnest. He performed in Philadelphia and then New York City. By the summer of 1963, he had performed in most major cities and had been invited to be a guest on The Tonight Show. The following year, he released his first comedy album. While many comedians wanted to push the boundaries of culture, either bordering on obscenity or wading into race relations, Cosby's humor focused largely on stories of his childhood and personal experiences. He had an amazing ability to unite people and create a universal sentiment rather than poking fun or pointing out the flaws of one section of society. Cosby was wildly popular as a comedian who really didn't offend any groups. He is credited as an inspiration for more recent comedians such as Jerry Seinfeld, who also makes a living without being graphic or offensive. Cosby was also cast in a number of television shows in the 60s and 70s, and then struck gold, getting his own family-oriented comedy show. The Cosby Show was a smash hit from 1984 through 1992. We don't have time to go through Cosby's entire career accolades, but chances are if you're listening to the show, you're familiar enough with Cosby and you know he's been a national name for about 60 years in the entertainment world. Now, while his public persona was largely contained in comedy, Cosby did also use his platform to discuss the status of African Americans in society. Cosby was a known, outspoken critic of what he perceived to be ghetto culture. He would frequently lecture the African-American community to stop blaming others for their problems and to start focusing on the degradation of the black family and black values for poverty and the failure to achieve upward mobility. This was a polarizing position for Cosby to take, but he was certainly no advocate for conservative or right-wing politics. He strongly felt that the Republican Party was unwilling to do their part to help the plight of black people in America. But he also felt that the political left was too focused on placing blame rather than actually doing what needed to be done to obtain positive results. And that's basically how Cosby's career went for years. He was mostly doing comedy, but he would be invited to speak at things like commencement ceremonies or other formal events where he would sometimes voice his positions on things outside of the entertainment world. He was considered a prominent figure in the black community. Hushed accusations of sexual misconduct were sort of in the ether, but Cosby somehow managed to always come across squeaky clean. Nobody publicly called him out or accused him. Privately, stories circulated about people who had been associated with him who'd claimed they'd been drugged or given some substance and then sexually assaulted. But again, nobody ever made a police report or went on late-night talk shows or held a press conference to denounce him. It was largely a rumor mill where someone heard from a friend who knew somebody who was at a party with someone who had been molested. That is, until Hannibal Buress. Hannibal Buress was a young, up-and-coming stand-up comic trying out new material. I'm going to quote his skit, omitting the profanity, because this is a family program. Buress' skit goes, "Bill Cosby has the effing smuggest old man black persona that I hate. He gets on TV. Pull your pants up, black people. I was on TV in the 80s. I can talk down to you because I had a successful sitcom. Yeah, but you rape women, Bill Cosby, so turn down the crazy a couple notches." Now, putting aside the fact that the bit isn't funny at all, if you watch the clip, Buress' Cosby impression is awful. But the bit did go viral and started a national conversation about Cosby's behavior. After this, a flood of women started publicly accusing Cosby of sexual assault, though no one really reported him to law enforcement. Many women claimed that his misconduct dated back to the 80s, 70s, and even the 60s, where the statute of limitations had long run. I assume most people here are familiar with the statute of limitations. But for those of you who might have heard the term but are a little fuzzy, here's a quick explanation. In general, when a person commits a crime, there's a certain period of time in which the victim needs to report the crime to the police or the defendant needs to be arrested. A person who steals a candy bar from a bodega in New York City does not need to be worried 20 years later that at any point they could be arrested for petty larceny. This time period starts running from either the date of the incident, if that date is known, for example, an assault, a robbery, a burglary, a bank robbery, or in the alternative, the date at which the criminal conduct is discovered, such as the crime of an employee embezzling money from a company, where the theft actually occurred months or maybe years prior, but was discovered later. The period of time between the conduct and the discovery doesn't count for the purposes of the statute of limitations. There are also some nuanced rules about when children are victims and the clock doesn't start until they turn 18. We don't need to go into all of that for this particular show. Once the period of time, the statute of limitations, has expired, no charges can be brought, and the person can sleep soundly knowing that they can no longer be prosecuted for their criminal behavior. The length of time which comprises the statute of limitations is based primarily on the severity of the crime. The more serious the crime, the longer the period of statute of limitations where a person can be the subject of a criminal complaint and then prosecuted. In New York and many other jurisdictions, there are only two crimes which have no statute of limitations, meaning you can be arrested whenever after the fact. Those crimes are murder and rape in the first degree. Anything other than those two, and there is some clock which is winding down. Now, in Pennsylvania, where Cosby's situation takes place, sexual assault does have a time limit. There is a statute of limitations of 12 years from the date of the commission of the offense. So this brings us to Andrea Constant. Constant was the reporter who made allegations against Cosby to law enforcement, which ultimately ended up in his criminal trial. Here's what she claimed. Constant is a Canadian-born former professional basketball player. In 2002, she became the director of basketball operations at Temple University. Now, Cosby has always maintained close ties with Temple, and especially with its basketball program. Cosby and Constant became friendly. Constant felt that Cosby was a mentor to her, both personally and professionally. Cosby invited Constant to his Cheltenham residence on a few occasions. Cheltenham is a fairly affluent suburb north of Philadelphia. In 2005, Constant, who had moved back to Canada, contacted her local police department to claim that Cosby had drugged and sexually assaulted her in January of 2004. The allegations went from Canadian law enforcement to the Montgomery County PD, where Cosby's Cheltenham home is located. Every time that a person reports that a crime has been committed, the district attorney makes a decision about whether to charge the individual accused. It is exclusively the district attorney who can charge people with state crimes. Police can make an arrest, but if the DA elects not to charge, they're just set free. The vast majority of the time, the DA decides to go forward with charging the person without too much thought. But in some situations, this initial determination becomes a fairly difficult decision. So what does the DA consider? The first and most important consideration is how credible the person making the allegation is. Is their story believable? Does it make sense? If they have to tell multiple people their story, is it consistent? After that, the DA will consider other factors like, did the person report the crime immediately? What type of relationship the parties had before and after the alleged incident, and their behaviors? Whether the accused has any sort of criminal history, and whether there are any concrete allegations of past misconduct. Now, this is a superficial list, but you get the idea. Constant claimed that in January of 2004, she went to Cosby's home to discuss a professional decision she had to make. She claims Cosby gave her a few unidentified blue pills, which she took and caused her to black out. She claims that she semi-consciously remembers Cosby fondling her and inserting his fingers inside her. She claimed when she woke up, he was nonchalant, and she left. She intended to confront him later, but didn't. She moved back to Canada, but accepted invitations for both herself and her mother to attend comedy shows when Cosby performed in Canada. In January 2005, she finally told her mother what happened, and then they decided to contact law enforcement. The Montgomery County DA at the time was a man named Bruce Castor. He immediately publicly opened an investigation into Cosby. His office interviewed Constand a few times, but noted that there were several material inconsistencies in her story, and that gave them pause. Handwritten notes taken from an interview with Bill Cosby also indicate that the interviewers believed Cosby was being forthright and honest about the encounter, and that his story remained consistent with a lot of what Constant had said, except for the part about her lack of consent. Castor then received authorization to search Cosby's home for any illegal date rape pills, which unsurprisingly returned nothing. And over a year later, there was virtually no chance of finding any evidence to corroborate whether a sexual assault had actually happened there. Castor was uncomfortable with the evidence he had. Constant had delayed making her report for an entire year. In that time, she had seen Cosby socially on a few occasions and had multiple conversations with him over the phone. She had continued to seek career advice and communicate with him as a mentor. She had gone to comedy shows he had put on as his guest and had brought her mother along. Cosby had not denied that some sexual contact had occurred. He had merely insisted that it was consensual, and at no point had intercourse or anything non-consensual ever taken place. There were rumors of Cosby acting inappropriately with other women in the past, but he'd never been arrested or publicly accused of anything. On the other hand, Castor felt that Constand really didn't have any reason to fabricate this incident. She'd not had a falling out with Cosby or a fight, and it's not uncommon for sexual assault victims to delay making a report as they struggle internally to determine what they should do. And Cosby did admit to giving Constand pills prior to their sexual contact, though he claimed they were Benadryl. Castor really could have gone either way, but he discovered one additional piece of information which swayed him. Prior to contacting the police in Canada, Constant had called a number of civil litigation firms in Philadelphia for the purpose of pursuing a financial windfall in filing a lawsuit against Cosby. Again, this is not proof that what Constant said did or didn't happen, but it's a factor which weighs into her credibility if a reasonable person would think that she's fabricating a situation in order to try to extort a settlement from him and make money rather than to pursue justice for his criminal behavior. In that case, the DA will be less likely to move forward. Castor's office sent a press release out saying, quote, "There was insufficient, credible, and admissible evidence upon which any charge against Cosby related to the Constand incident could be proven beyond a reasonable doubt," end quote. As you've heard me say over and over again in this podcast, from the DA's perspective, it isn't really about whether they believe a crime happened. It's about whether they believe they have enough evidence to prove their case to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Castor simply didn't believe that he had that. But Castor genuinely felt for Constant and wanted to help her. Rightly or wrongly, Castor felt that Constant's best chance was to sue Cosby in civil court, where the burden of proof is lower. This is a key fact to pay close attention to. To make it easier for her to sue, Castor acting on behalf of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, entered into an agreement with Cosby's attorneys, indicating that Pennsylvania would not pursue criminal charges against Cosby for the Constand matter. And this agreement had massive implications. The goal of the agreement was to remove an obstacle that Cosby could erect in his civil defense. In a criminal prosecution, when a person is arrested and charged, they have a Fifth Amendment right to keep silent and not say anything which implicates them in a crime. They do not have to be subject to interrogation by the police, and they cannot be compelled to take the witness stand at a trial and ask questions. It is an absolute right. This right, though, extends beyond the criminal process. An individual can assert their Fifth Amendment rights at any formal proceeding where he or she is being asked a question which, if answered, may implicate them in criminal activity. You may see this in things like congressional hearings, where a person does not have the ability to ignore a subpoena to appear, but still cannot be compelled to confess to a crime. Another place you frequently see the Fifth Amendment asserted is in civil depositions. In a civil lawsuit, a defendant does not have the ability to refuse to submit to a deposition, but they do have the right to refuse to answer any question which may put them in danger of criminal prosecution by virtue of confessing to a crime. What Bruce Castor was doing was removing Cosby's ability to assert the Fifth Amendment, because he was saying that, since Pennsylvania is agreeing not to prosecute you for this incident, you are in no danger of criminal prosecution, and therefore the Fifth Amendment does not apply to your situation. Constand found out that the DA was not going to pursue the criminal case from her civil attorneys, who had read the press release. Now, in his depositions in the civil case, Cosby could not invoke his rights and answered all the questions he was asked. On a few occasions, he did try to refuse to answer questions, but Constand's attorneys were able to secure orders from the civil court judge that Cosby had to respond based on his lack of Fifth Amendment protections. Cosby maintained the pills he provided were Benadryl, but he admitted to the sexual contact. And then he admitted that he had offered to pay for Constand's education after, though he denied it was an attempt to buy any silence. Overall, Cosby made several incriminating statements regarding his actions because he did not want to commit perjury, a crime for which he certainly still could be prosecuted, and because he believed he could not be prosecuted for the sexual assault. Ultimately, the lawsuit settled, and the terms and records of the civil case were sealed. There was no huge news story. It was quiet and private. And I assume that when this case settled, both parties felt this was the end of the matter. But it turns out that it wasn't. Bruce Castor elected not to run for district attorney again in the following election in 2007. He was succeeded by one of his chief deputies, Risa Furman. She had worked closely with Castor for years. In 2015, a media request was made to the federal judge who presided over the civil matter, asking to unseal the records of the case and settlement for a story. The judge granted it. Now, this is right around the time that Hannibal Buress' stand-up routine had started going viral. It was then publicized that Constand had received $3.38 million, and Cosby's depositions became available. Furman, who claimed that she was completely unaware of the agreement made by Castor and Cosby's attorneys, decided to prosecute. Now, at this point, in 2015, they are 11 years into the 12-year statute of limitations. She brought charges against Bill Cosby for the sexual assault of Andrea Constand. Upon hearing this, Bruce Castor reached out to Furman to urge her to abide by his agreement. He laid out in detail what the terms were and advised her that there is simply no way that she could use Cosby's deposition statements in a civil case as part of a criminal prosecution, and that he had promised no prosecution would ever ensue for these actions. Furman's testimony regarding her ignorance of the initial agreement is shaky at best. In my personal opinion, she's lying about not having known about the agreement at the time. It's virtually inconceivable that the top deputy of the office, which Furman was in 2005, would not know about an agreement not to prosecute the highest profile suspect that the office had at the time, and her testimony on the subject was completely unconvincing. As an aside, Furman is now a judge in Pennsylvania. Regardless, even if Furman learned about the agreement for the first time in 2014 from Castor's email, she completely ignored it, disregarded the email, and proceeded anyway. She sent investigators to Canada to urge Constant to cooperate with their prosecution. As part of the civil settlement, Constant was prohibited from doing so, but agreed to anyway. So Cosby is arrested on December 30th, 2015. As you can imagine, the first thing his lawyers do is file a motion to dismiss based on the fact that Bruce Castor had entered into an agreement with them not to prosecute. The trial judge, the Honorable Judge Stephen O'Neill, was presented with a dilemma. On one side, he had public opinion. Cosby had admitted in depositions what happened. There was a firestorm regarding his conduct in the media now. He had testified under oath about his actions. He had a criminal defendant in front of him who had essentially confessed, and the media was everywhere. On top of that, there was technically never a written agreement between Bruce Castor and Cosby's attorneys. It was all oral. On the other hand, legally, the case should clearly have been dismissed immediately. Bruce Castor had submitted an affidavit on behalf of Cosby, telling the judge that while district attorney, he had entered into a binding agreement with Cosby that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania was bound by this agreement and could not prosecute. An agreement does not have to be reduced to writing to be enforceable if both parties agree on the terms and strike the deal. That clearly happened here, and both parties were specifically instructing the judge as such. O'Neill decided to ignore due process and justice and make the decision he felt would be more popular with society in general. He denied the defense motion. He claimed that the agreement had merely been, quote, a contemplation of immunity, end quote, and that no actual immunity had ever been conferred. The judge said he also felt that Castor's testimony in front of him about the grant of immunity was unclear. I've read Castor's testimony. It is crystal clear on this particular issue. Judge O'Neill not only denied the defense motion to dismiss, he also decided to allow the deposition testimony to come in as evidence of Cosby's guilt. The judge next decided to allow the DA to call an additional witness, a woman named Kelly Johnson, to testify that Cosby had sexually assaulted her in 1996. This incident couldn't be prosecuted because it was outside the statute of limitations. Cosby's trial began June 5th, 2017. And we've already discussed the prosecution case. They argue that Cosby's a predator, he's not the wholesome man he portrays on TV, and he drugs and molests women. The defense, on the other hand, argued that Constant had no credibility. They go through all the issues with her changing stories, the delayed reporting, contacting civil lawyers before law enforcement. And after 6 days of deliberations, the jury tells Judge O'Neill that they are hopelessly deadlocked. They cannot make a decision. And the judge declares a mistrial. The DA immediately releases a statement that they will pursue a second trial. Cosby now hires Tom Massaro, the lawyer who represented Michael Jackson in his child molestation case, for the second trial. Shortly before the second trial begins, the DA files a motion requesting the ability to call 19 additional women to testify about alleged sexual misconduct by Cosby, which occurred in the past. Cosby's defense team argued that these incidents were improper character evidence, that they were too remote in time to be relevant to this trial, that they were inflammatory and prejudicial without being able to really help the jury make a determination on the question of guilt. And despite literally no change in circumstances at all between the first and the second trial, Judge O'Neill decides that this is legally appropriate, that this testimony will be relevant as the additional witnesses will show that Cosby's actions cannot be considered accidental and is being called other for the purposes than to attack Cosby's character. So he allows the DA to call 5 additional women, with incidents ranging from 1982 to 1989. 15 years between the most recent incident and the incident which took place for the trial. The judge also did issue a ruling favorable to the defense. They could now call Marguerite Jackson, an acquaintance of Constant, who testified that Constant spoke to her about framing a celebrity prior to filing her sexual abuse allegations against Cosby. In the second trial, the arguments were the same. But in the second trial, Cosby was convicted and ultimately sentenced to 3 to 10 years in Pennsylvania State Prison for aggravated sexual assault. Naturally, Cosby appealed, and the appellate division sided with Judge O'Neill and upheld every aspect of his conviction. They determined the decisions regarding the motion to dismiss, the use of the depositions, and the introduction of all the prior bad acts were appropriately decided. Cosby next went to the Court of Appeals. In a scathing decision, the Court of Appeals overturned Cosby's conviction. Let's look at why and who was ultimately right. There were two issues which the Court of Appeals looked at. First, could Risa Furman bring charges against Cosby in lieu of the agreement Castor had clearly entered into? And could they use Cosby's civil depositions in a criminal trial? Second, was admitting the testimony of the additional sexual assault victims proper, or was it reversible error? On the first topic, the Court of Appeals found, unequivocally, that it was a heinous miscarriage of justice for Furman to bring charges. Because of the unique position that prosecutors have in society, it is imperative that a criminal defendant be able to take them at their word. If a district attorney can go back on a promise made to a defendant, it would essentially undermine the fair administration of justice. The judges specifically pointed out that a prosecutor's job is not to secure convictions in every case. If you've listened to some previous episodes, you've doubtless heard me rant about this from time to time. Rather, the job of the DA is to ensure that justice is done. Sometimes that means convicting defendants. Other times, it means ensuring that due process and fundamental notions of fairness are followed, regardless of whether that means a conviction is pursued. There was no question by anyone that Castor entered into an agreement with Cosby, and that the agreement was that he would not be prosecuted, and as a result, he could not assert his Fifth Amendment rights in the civil case. As a result, Cosby was basically forced to answer questions in the civil case, which he would not have otherwise had to answer. At this point, Cosby has, whether voluntarily or not, relied on the promise made by the DA to his own detriment. It is offensive to our system of fairness for the DA to turn around and say that, armed with these incriminating statements, we are now going to charge you. The Court of Appeals wrote, quote, "When a prosecutor makes an unconditional promise of non-prosecution, and when the defendant relies on that guarantee to the detriment of his constitutional right not to testify, the principle of fundamental fairness that undergirds due process of law in our criminal justice system demands that the promise be enforced." End quote. The Court of Appeals then specifically addressed the argument that the appropriate remedy would be a third trial, in which the deposition testimony could not be used. Some additional briefs had been filed advocating for that, instead of simply barring any prosecution of Cosby. They said it would be fundamentally fair to prosecute him without the depositions, as that is when the rights violation allegedly occurred. This argument was completely rejected by the Court of Appeals. They held that the due process violation here was so vast and that Furman's actions were so outrageous that the remedy was insufficient. Cosby's harm extended beyond using his deposition in the criminal case. It cost him a lot of money through the civil case as well, and thus it would be incorrect to say that he would be put on the same footing that he would have been had his civil depositions not been used. The court didn't even bother to answer the second appellate issue, as they held that Cosby should be barred from any future prosecution for the incident relating to Andrea Constant, and thus Cosby was released and is now a free man. In summation, I have a lot of feelings on this. First and foremost, I would like to see Risa Furman kicked off the bench. Based on her conduct as DA, I do not think she's qualified or ethically capable of discharging her duties as a judge. She is the type of hard-charging, immoral prosecutor which you see in movies, who views the law and the basic principles of fairness in the criminal justice system as nothing more than an obstruction to throwing people in jail for as long as possible. I do always try to give people the benefit of the doubt, but after reading her testimony and her justification for charging Cosby and her defense of using the deposition testimony, I honestly believe this woman should be disbarred. Second, with regards to Judge O'Neill, I've known many judges who are less concerned with what is legally proper and more concerned with what they feel in their gut is the moral or right outcome. They're willing to bend the rule of law to accomplish the result they think is best for society. Again, just my own opinion here, but this is perhaps the most dangerous thing a judge can do. It's completely and utterly wrong, and no judge should ever substitute their own personal judgment for what the law actually is. This system only works when everyone, that means defendants, defense lawyers, prosecutors, and judges, all agree to abide by the same set of rules governing the institution. When any party feels that they can arbitrarily change the rules and has the authority to do so, it will lead to injustice. It should be clarified that this is a position wholly separate from the notion of invalidating unconstitutional laws. That certainly is a function of the judiciary, and an important one. But that isn't what we're discussing here. Furman didn't argue that Castor's agreement should be disregarded because it was an unconstitutional exercise of power. All parties specifically agreed that as DA, Castor was the only person who actually did have the power to enter into the type of an agreement which was actually struck. Rather, Furman's argument was that from a policy perspective, we want to prosecute sex offenders and nothing should be able to get in our way. If you are a citizen of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, that should terrify you. Not because every citizen there is a sex offender, but because the mindset of the DA's office is that justice and the rule of law take a back seat to meeting out punishment in that county, and it appears that at least one trial judge is on board with that idea. Now, I've had a lot of debate about the merits of the Court of Appeals decision. If you follow the show's Facebook page, you've seen one discussion with a good friend of mine who adamantly feels that the conviction should have been allowed to stand. Here's what I've noticed about these discussions in general. Usually, not always, but usually, the two sides are coming at the issue from perspectives which are not actually at odds with each other. They're just focusing on different aspects of the decision. Proponents of the conviction are horrified by Cosby's behavior. They believe that sexual predators should be jailed, and that this is a case where a person who we all pretty much universally agree sexually assaulted women, and not just Andrea Constand, was put in jail, but then let out. These people are focused on society, and believe that the community is better off and safer with Cosby and men like Cosby behind bars. In their mind, the system here worked, and a bad man who hurt a lot of women is getting punished. And that's a good thing. The argument focuses on safety and punishment. Proponents of Cosby's release typically agree with almost everything their opponents say. But instead of focusing on the community's safety concerns, they view the situation through the lens of what is legally proper or not. The DA specifically entered into a very clear agreement with Cosby for the purpose of affecting the civil case, which it did. In exactly the way it was intended to, in order to achieve the result which the DA felt was desirable. To be clear, they are not defending Cosby. They are not saying he's factually innocent or that his behavior is acceptable. They acknowledge that he is a predator and, in a perfect world, would have been convicted decades ago and serving a long prison sentence. But that isn't the world we live in. We live in a world of institutions, where the laws and the legal system matter, where promises made by those in a position to bring charges must be kept. My mind immediately thinks of what the net results would be if we had a policy following Furman's actions here. plea bargaining would essentially come to a standstill. What defendant is going to plead guilty on a promise that the DA will recommend a certain sentence if they could just turn around and recommend the max afterwards? Also, why would any person ever cooperate with the DA? If I enter into a cooperation agreement in exchange for leniency in my own case and have an agreement about what my sentence will be if I provide certain information, and then I testify against people worse than me, and then the DA turns around and pushes for me to get the max too, why would anybody ever agree to cooperate? This system simply won't work if we don't hold prosecutors to their word. And I honestly don't think that many prosecutors would disagree. They recognize that the ability to be taken at their word induces defendants to do things that they want them to do. And if that goes away, the system will grind to a halt. The Court of Appeals was 100% right to hold the Montgomery County DA to Castor's deal and bar them from prosecuting Cosby again. Let me be crystal clear. I think Bill Cosby is a sexual predator. My position is a global reinforcement and endorsement of the rule of law. I am as abhorred by what he did as anyone else. But I also recognize that the DA at the time felt he didn't have enough to go forward, so he made the best deal he thought he could. Whether you like it or not, that deal absolutely has to bind both parties, not just one. Anything else would erode the bedrock principles of justice upon which our whole system is built. So that's the show on Bill Cosby. I apologize. I ranted and rambled, and the show ran a little bit long. If that was okay, and you don't mind the show getting a little longer, again, please let me know. If you'd prefer I keep them shorter, then you don't need to do anything. I will revert back to the standard time for the next episode. But there was too much to cover this time around, and I really didn't want to cut out any more than I already did. Thanks, as always, to Dan Townsend, my audio engineer, who keeps the audio quality up, though he disavows the content. And thank you to everyone who has already engaged in conversation about the Cosby appeal. These are important conversations to have, and it's never wrong to debate and voice opinions, as long as you're willing to keep an open mind and respectfully listen and consider what your opponents believe. Please visit insummation.com and check out my website. Leave me feedback there. Check out some of the articles I've written on topics we've covered previously. As always, you can email me directly at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up the old-fashioned way on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please check out the entire catalog. Subscribe and get notified anytime a new episode gets posted every other week. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.